We're in Ecclesiastes this morning, continuing our study through the book. Expect to finish, Lord willing, in another 2 or 3 weeks, maybe a month at the outside. And we have just come through a portion of the book in chapter 8, verse 16 through 9, 12, where Kohelet tells us that you can't count on your own strength and you can't count on your own wisdom. God is in control of everything. Your own strength and your own wisdom are futile because circumstances may change underneath you and you may find yourself surprised. And there's a conclusion that the world draws from that. That's an observation that Solomon makes. It's an observation that the world makes too. You see people that work real hard for years and years and years and their whole world collapses around them. People that study and become very wise, at least in the world's terms, and yet they don't meet with any success. Well, the world's conclusion, one conclusion, is the conclusion of what's called existentialism, which says that life is meaningless. There's no point to anything, so you may as well not try. Just quit living. Just ultimately destroy yourself. That's what a lot of people end up with. That's the frustration of our age. Well, their analysis of the situation is correct. You cannot, by your own strength, guarantee your own happiness. You can't. The way God has made the world, time and chance happen to all men. But the conclusion that the unbeliever reaches is wrong. The unbeliever says, because I can't guarantee my own happiness, therefore why bother working? God says, I have given you work to be your daily portion. I have given you wisdom to be your guide in life. Therefore, even though you cannot guarantee your own destiny, you are still to seek wisdom and you are still to work. Not because you're going to make yourself happy by doing that, but because that's what I've given to you. It's my will that you seek wisdom. It's my will that you work. Therefore, seek wisdom. Therefore, work. Now, you notice I keep talking about these two terms. One is work and the other is wisdom. Well, last week we began looking at the need for wisdom in 9:13 through 10:15. Why is it that even though wisdom cannot guarantee happiness, I should still seek to be wise? We're going to finish up our discussion of that this morning, Lord willing, and then we'll undertake in 10:16 through 11:6, question, why should I work? If my labor cannot guarantee my own happiness, why should I exert myself in working? Now, Kohelet addresses this question of why seek after wisdom largely by considering what happens to you if you don't have wisdom. Maybe wisdom doesn't guarantee happiness, but ignorance is a lot worse. He's going on to show now the consequences of folly. What happens to the fool? What can the fool expect, by and large, as a general rule of thumb in life? Last time, we considered the relationship between wisdom and folly. We saw that wisdom is, in general, able to bring better results than folly, but folly is like a poison. It undoes a lot of good. Remember the picture of the dead flies in the perfume? It only takes a few dead flies to spoil a whole pot of perfume. It only takes a little bit of foolishness to outweigh the effects of a lot of wisdom. Folly is a powerful thing. It's very destructive. And we considered last time the effects of folly in a place of authority. In verses 4 through 7, if the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, this is chapter 10, verses 4 through 7. If the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place, for yielding pacifieth great offenses. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, as an error which proceedeth from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity, and the rich sit in low place. I have seen servants upon horses, and princes walking as servants upon the earth. Now these verses, as we said last time, show the effects of folly in high places. Rulers who are fools tend to set up people under them who are fools as well. And you end up with fools ruling over the wise, servants in high places, nobles in low positions, complete confusion and chaos. Why should we seek after wisdom? Well, wisdom is important if you have any kind of a leadership position, to know how to manage the people that are under you, whether you're a manager at work or whether you're a parent in the home. The consequences of folly in leadership are terrible. Now today we'll talk about not only folly in leadership, but also the consequences of folly in labor, and finally the consequences of folly in speech. The consequences of folly in labor are outlined in verses 8, 9, 10, and 11 of chapter 10. Chapter 10 of Ecclesiastes, verses 8, 9, 10, and 11. He that diggeth a pit shall fall into it, and whoso breaketh a hedge, a serpent shall bite him. Whoso removeth stones shall be hurt therewith, and he that cleaveth wood shall be in danger thereby. If the iron be blunt and he do not whet the edge, then must he put to more strength, but wisdom is profitable to direct. Surely the serpent will bite without enchantment, and a babbler is no better. Now he's drawing two pictures for us here. The first picture is somebody who's working in the field. The second picture is somebody who's building a house. So here's somebody working in the field. And what are the kind of things you might have to do if you're working in the field? Well, one thing you might have to do if you're working in the field is dig a pit to throw your garbage into. And if you're going to try to plant plants here, there might be a big bush here. It's called a hedge in our verse. You might have to get rid of that hedge. So what you want to do is cut down the hedge so you can plant your crops and put all the garbage into the pit and cover it over with dirt, and then you've got a nice smooth field and you can plant your crops. But the person who digs a pit, if he's not careful, what might happen to him? He digs a hole, the dinner bell rings, he goes home to dinner. After supper he thinks, oh my, I bet you I left the shovel out there. It'll get rusty. So he goes out. It's dark. He walks out in the field to find his shovel. What do you think he does, Ryan? He falls into the pit. He steps right smack into his own hole and falls in the bottom of the pit. And then he screams like mad, somebody come and get me out. This is the fool at work. Folly in labor. He digs a pit and falls into it. Or he's cutting down this hedge. And he doesn't pay attention to the fact that maybe somewhere inside the hedge... What's that? Well, I wish it were a worm. In this case, it's a snake. It's a poisonous snake. And the man goes to cut down the hedge, and he isn't careful. He doesn't watch where he's putting his hand, and what do you think happens? The snake comes out and bites him. Bites him. This is the fool at work. You know, there are dangers in our daily work, and the fool doesn't watch out for those dangers. Verse 11 tells us that the serpent will bite without enchantment, and a babbler is no better. Actually, the second half of that verse 11 is probably still talking about the snake charmer. If the serpent bites without the charm, then there is no advantage for the charmer. The most that this fool tries to do in protecting himself from snakes that are hiding in the bushes is utter a charm. Now, you tell me how much good a snake charm is. Can you charm a snake? No. Here's this fool, and he's relying on a charm to deliver him from the snake. Does him no good. He digs a pit and falls in. He tries to clear away a hedge. A snake comes out and bites him. Now, wise men get bitten by snakes too, and wise men fall in pits too, but not as often as fools do. You see the danger of being a fool in labor? The next set of illustrations in verses 9 and 10, you'll notice that these are arranged chiastically, by the way, the problem with snakes on the outside, the problem with stones and wood in the center, verses 9 and 10, is a man who's building a house. Whoso removeth stone shall be hurt therewith. We're talking about a man who's cutting stone in the quarries, cutting blocks of limestone to build a house. Or he's cleaving wood. What does cleave mean? Split. Split. You going to say that, Ryan? He's splitting wood. He's taking logs and he's splitting them into beams to put up in his house. But if you cut stones in the quarry, they can fall on your feet and smash them. And if you're splitting wood, have you ever split wood or seen somebody split wood? My daddy used to split wood for our fireplace. Have a log like this, and you have a thing called a wedge, which is a pointed thing like this. And he'd stick it in the top of the wood like this, and then he'd pound on it with a hammer right here. Big, heavy hammer. Pound on that, and if everything went well, there would be a crack. It would come right down the middle of the wood, and it would fall into two pieces. But if everything didn't go well, this wedge will come flying out of that log like a bullet. And if your head's in the way, it can really hurt you. If you split wood, you can be endangered by it. The fool at work is likely to get hurt. And what's the answer to this problem? Well, verse 10. If the iron be blunt, and he do not whet or sharpen the edge, then must he put to more strength. That is, the fool doesn't know that he's got to have a sharp axe to cut wood. He tries to cut wood with a dull axe. He tries to cut stone with dull chisels. And the result is you've got chisels and wedges and axes flying all over the place, and he's cutting himself in the leg and hitting himself in the head, and he comes home at the end of the day, he looks as though he's been in a war. That's the consequence of folly in labor. Just as folly in leadership led to people in the wrong positions in leadership, folly in labor means you're going to be hurt by your own work. Wisdom cannot guarantee happiness, but folly can almost guarantee complete unhappiness. The fool, the consequences of folly in labor. How about the consequences of folly in speech?
Okay,
well, now we look in verse 12. The words of a man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool will swallow up himself. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is mischievous madness. A fool also is full of words. A man cannot tell what shall be, and what shall be after him, who can tell him? The labor of the foolish wearieth every one of them, because he knoweth not how to go to the city. Now these all talk, in one way or another, about the speech of the fool. Let's consider these four characteristics of the speech of the fool. It's malicious, it's nonsense, there's too much of it, and it's annoying. That's what these verses tell us about the fool's speech. When he opens his mouth, everyone knows he's a fool. First of all, in verse 12, a fool's speech is malicious. That's a good $25 word. What's malicious mean? What do I mean when I say a speech is malicious? You know that word, Drew? Malice? It means it hurts people. A fool's speech tends to hurt people. Here's a little poem that you all know. Sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Now, when do you say that little poem? When somebody else is trying to hurt you with his words. And probably the reason you say that little poem is because deep down inside, the words do hurt, don't they? It does hurt when somebody talks mean about you. Words can hurt very badly. Children say sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me. But that's not what the Bible says. The Bible says that the words of a talebearer are like arrows going down into the depths of the soul. The Bible says that words can really hurt people. And the fool uses his speech to hurt other people. Look at verse 12. The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool will swallow up himself. A wise man speaks graciously. He's always kind in his speech, even when he has something unpleasant to say. Remember Paul? Remember how Paul writes his letters? He's writing to the Corinthians. They're doing all sorts of terrible things in the church. But he starts off by thanking God that they come behind in no gift. He starts off by speaking very positively of them. Very kind, very gracious. And then later, when he's assured them of his love and his friendship, he chastises and corrects them. There is a need sometimes to say things about people that aren't positive. We sometimes have to tell people about their faults, about their problems. But we must learn to do it in a positive and kind and gracious manner. That's the wise way. The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool are so malicious, they are so hurtful, that they will swallow up himself. They not only hurt the person he's talking to, they will also consume himself. Now, the second characteristic of the fool's words is that they are nonsense. That's verse 13. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is mischievous madness. It doesn't make any sense at all. He just talks nonsense. No content to it. And this ought to be a warning to us about nonsense talking. In fact, we have an admonition earlier in this book, chapter 5, verse 2. God is in heaven, you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. You know, there are a lot of things in this world that just aren't worth talking about. What does Ephesians 5:12 say? Have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them, for it is a shame even to speak of those things which are done of them in secret. You know, there are some things in this world that it's a shame even to talk about. And the people who consider themselves the wisest and consider themselves the most sophisticated insist that freedom of speech means that they can talk about everything in the sewer, and they spend all their time talking about it. That's a fool. That's someone who is speaking nonsense, madness.
he babbles on about mischievous madness. Watch what you talk about. The fool talks about nonsense, nonsense by God's standards. And he does it too much. He talks too much. Verse 14, a fool also is full of words. You poke him anywhere and words leak out automatically. He's like a water balloon full of water. All you have to do is poke it and water comes out all over the place. That's the way a fool is. You just touch him and he starts talking. Blah, 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 blah. No, remember what Kohelet says. God is in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. In the multitude of words, there wanteth not sin. James warns us about the sin that we fall into when we talk too much. Watch your mouth. Guard it. Loquaciousness is not a godly trait. Do you know what loquacious means? Somebody is loquacious if they talk a lot. Loquaciousness is not a godly thing. The last part of the verse tells us that a man cannot tell what shall be and what shall be after him. Who can tell him? You don't know anything. You don't know what your life holds in store. You don't know what God has for you. What do you have so much to talk about? Oh, I'm going to do this and this and this and this. I'm going to make all these plans and then I'm going to go make $1 million here and then I'm going to retire to my estate in the country and blah, 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 blah. Shh, quiet. You don't know what life holds for you. You talk too much. Better to listen to God and see what He has to say to you. A fool's words are malicious. They're talking about nonsense, things that aren't worth talking about. They are abundant. And the fourth characteristic of the fool's words is annoying. Verse 15. The labor of the foolish wearieth every one of them, because he knoweth not how to go to the city. Here's a fool. He's going to try to do something. He's going to try to be productive. So he's going to go to town. How do I get to town? I don't know how I get to town. Can't find the street to go to town. So I'm going to ask somebody, how do I get to town? So he asks somebody, and they tell him, and he starts to do it, but before long he's forgotten it, and so he asks somebody else, how do I get to town? All day long he's asking people how to get to town. Now I'll tell you something. There's one thing about towns that you got to keep in mind. We tend not to remember it with interstates. But what's the major road north of Broadway in the northwestern section of town? What is the big road in Ann Arbor? Plymouth Road. Why is it called Plymouth Road? It goes to Plymouth. Thank you. And if you were at the other end of that road in Plymouth, what's it called? Ann Arbor Road. That's not just Plymouth in Ann Arbor, folks. That's everywhere in the world. We were visiting Anita's cousin in Paris. He took us out to the little town where Anita's uncle used to live, Tillières. And the road that goes from Tillières to Paris, what do you think it's called? Paris Street. Yeah, that's the road to Paris. Finding your way to town is easy. Now, finding your way to the post office or the train station or something else, once you get to town, is hard. Finding your way to town is easy. You just find the main road and follow it. The fool can't even do that. And so he's always asking everyone around him, which is the way to town? Which is the way to town? He can't find his way to the city, and he wears out everybody. The labor of the foolish wearieth every one of them. He wears everybody out with his ceaseless and senseless questions because he doesn't pay attention the first time. That's the words of the fool. Now, remember, wisdom cannot guarantee your personal happiness, but look at the consequences of wisdom. In leadership, you will mess up the organization that you're responsible for. In labor, you're likely to hurt yourself. In speech, you will find yourself becoming malicious, harming not only others, but yourself. You'll be speaking nonsense, too much of it, and you'll be annoying to those around you. Wisdom cannot guarantee success or happiness, but it's better than folly. So although, if you're wise, you don't control your own destiny, still, don't be foolish. Wisdom is better than folly. And a little folly, remember the flies and the perfume, a little folly can overcome a whole lot of wisdom. So that's why we should pursue wisdom. God has given that to us to guide our lives. It will not guarantee happiness. Time and chance happen to all men. But that does not justify giving up and saying, well, I'll just be a fool then, because the fool's lot is miserable. Now, how about work? You cannot work your way to happiness or success either. But in chapter 10, verse 16 through 11, 6, we have exhortations and admonitions about the value of work. And here we have it in two forms. First of all, toward the end of chapter 10, we will learn the consequences of sloth.
What's sloth? What's sloth, John? You know what sloth is? Who knows what sloth is?
Ryan and Gene know what sloth is. Rachel know what sloth is?
Sloth is what characterizes the sluggard. Do you know what a sluggard is? And when somebody is slothful, we say they are lazy. In fact, sloth is so picturesque a term that people have given it as a name to an animal that does nothing but hang upside down in tree branches all day and sleep. Slothful, just sleeps all the time and moves very, very slowly. So the consequences of sloth, first of all, what will happen to you if you are slothful? And then we're going to talk about the value of diligence. Diligence is the opposite of sloth. Diligence is when you really work and you put your mind to things and you try to get ahead. The consequences of sloth and an exhortation to diligence. Well, the consequences of sloth begin at chapter 10, verse 16. He focuses our attention here on royalty, on the kings. Woe to thee, O land, when thy king is a child and thy princes eat in the morning. Blessed art thou, O land, when thy king is the son of nobles and thy princes eat in due season for strength and not for drunkenness. By much slothfulness the building decayeth, and through idleness of the hands the house droppeth through. A feast they make for laughter. Wine maketh merry, but money answereth all things. Curse not the king, no, not in thy thought. And curse not the rich in thy bedchamber, for a bird of the air shall carry the voice, and that which hath wings shall tell the matter. Now, to give us a good picture of the consequences of being lazy, Kohelet turns to the rich. That's because rich people have more of a chance to be lazy, and they tend to be lazier when they're lazy than poor people do. And the reason is simple. A poor man has to get up each day and go hoe in the field and bring home his food and eat it that night. And if he's lazy for too many days, he'll dry up and blow away. He can't afford to be lazy. He's got to eat. But a rich man, a king, all the taxes coming in from the country to pay all of his bills, if he's not very well disciplined, he can be very, very lazy. And thus some of the greatest examples of laziness come from kings. So, Kohelet says, let's look at the kings and the princes. Let's see how they live. And let's see what the consequences of sloth are. And verses 16 and 17 show us the two halves of this. They show us, first of all, a land that is unhappy. Woe to thee, O land, when thy king is a child, and thy princes eat in the morning. Blessed art thou, O land, when thy king is the son of nobles, and thy princes eat in due season, for strength and not for drunkenness. There are two contrasts. One about the nature of the king, and the other about the time that people eat. In the first verse, with the unhappy land, we have a king who is a child. And you have to understand that the word child in Hebrew can also mean servant. Same in Greek, by the way. And in fact, to some extent, in English. We're not used to having servants in our household, so we don't know how to talk about them. But 100 years ago, when people had servants in their households, they might refer to somebody as boy, even though he was 60 years old. Here, boy, take my shoes and shine them. It's intended to refer to servants as though they were children. And that's the attitude here. Woe to thee, O land, when thy king is a child. Blessed art thou, O land, when thy king is the son of nobles. The contrast is between being a king who is a noble person, who's been raised for the throne, who knows what a king should do, and someone who is a servant. Now, there's a characteristic about servants, and that is they never do any more than they have to do. Servants don't plan things. They're told what to do. And when they get to the end of what they're told to do, they stop doing it. After all, why should they do more? A servant doesn't get rich when what he's working on succeeds. He gets his food and his clothing, regardless of what happens. So a servant does whatever you tell him, and then he stops. What if the king is a servant? What if that's the attitude of the king? Who tells a king what to do? Nobody tells a king what to do. Well, if he has the attitude of a servant, he'll just sit on his hands and do nothing. Here I am, I'll eat and I'll drink until someone tells me something to do. But nobody can tell me what to do because I'm a king, so I won't do anything. Woe unto thee, O land, when thy king is a servant. But if your king is the son of nobles, if he's been raised
with the understanding that he will one day have to lead. And so he's been trained about all the responsibilities of a king. He's been trained about all the responsibilities of government and all the things that have to be done to keep a country going well, how to attend to the economic state of the country, how to take care of its defense needs, how to take care of the public works, what all these responsibilities are. Well, then the land is happy because the king won't be sitting on his hands. He won't be lazy. He'll be doing kingly things. How about the princes? You know who the princes are? They're the noble people that surround the king. Woe unto thee, O land, when thy princes eat in the morning. They get up in the morning, and the first thing they think about is food. You know, my wife cooks delicious dinners, and she usually cooks more than we need, so I get to eat it the next day for lunch, and I am the envy of ITI for my lunches. Everybody who sees me carrying these huge plates of beautiful home-cooked food, and they're all eating microwave sandwiches out of the dispensing machine that have been sitting there for 3 weeks in the dispensing machine. You know, they thought, boy, that's really great. But there's a disadvantage to these wonderful lunches. After I've had this big, beautiful lunch about 12 o'clock, I sit in the meeting about 2 or 3 in the afternoon. And boy, my eyelids get real heavy, and I start to... What's that? Oh, yes, that's a very interesting point. Yes, that's nice. I start to doze off again, and someone says something. Nope, I wake up again, and I rub my eyes, and yes, that's a good idea, and here's an idea too, and then I'll doze off again. That ever happened to you? Eat a big meal, and then you're just sleepy because your body's now working on digesting the meal. It doesn't want to think. It wants to digest. Well, what happens if you get up early in the morning and stuff your stomach with a bunch of food? Your body wants to sit around and digest it. You're not good for any work. So the princes get up in the morning, they take a big meal, and they sit around all morning just digesting their meal, and then it's lunchtime. So they have another big meal, and then they sit around till supper time, and they just eat all day long. That's all they do. That's their whole purpose in life, is to eat, 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 eat. They are controlled by food. The other side of the coin is in verse 17. Blessed art thou, O land, when thy princes eat in due season. They eat at the appropriate time. And they eat for strength and not for drunkenness. Actually, the Hebrew here is a little bit different. They eat in strength, not in drunkenness. The foolish princes eat in drunkenness. They are controlled by their food. They're drunken, and they just blindly seek for more to eat. The wise prince eats in strength, that is, in self-control. He eats because he needs to have food to strengthen his body, but he doesn't eat too much. He doesn't eat the wrong things. He doesn't eat at a bad time of day. He controls his eating. He also does not abstain from food more than he should. He gets enough food to care for his bodily needs. The food serves him. He doesn't serve the food. And now I get to tell a story that Gene's waiting for. Our first day in Europe, when we were visiting Steve and Terry this trip that we just came back from, we went to Heidelberg Castle. We visited lots and lots of castles, and they're very beautiful castles, but this one is interesting because it has a wine keg in it. Now, do you know what a wine keg looks like? It's a barrel like this. You know, and down here there's a spigot that comes out for the wine to come out of. How big is a wine keg? People at the university have beer parties, and they have little kegs about like this, you know. Maybe you've seen pictures of monasteries or castles that have wine kegs in it about the size of this lectern, you know, about 5 feet long, 3 feet across. This wine keg was 23 feet high. You had to climb up 49 steps to get to the top of it. And it was 28 feet long. They had to cut down 130 oak trees to make it. And it held, are you ready for this? 234,000 quarts of wine. That's almost 60,000 gallons of wine. And you might be tempted to pity the poor servants who had to fill buckets with this stuff and carry it upstairs to the dining hall. But that's okay. They were easy on the servants. They had the wine piped directly to the dining hall. They had a pipe going right from the wine, this wine thing down here with 60,000 gallons of wine, directly to the dining area so that everybody could have all they wanted. The court consumed about 2,100 quarts of wine a day. That is, they had to fill this thing three times each year to satisfy the needs of the castle. And in particular, there was one character in the court. His name was Perkio. He was the court jester. And the court jester was like a clown. He made people laugh. He was a dwarf. He was red-haired. And he drank about 16 quarts of wine every single day, all by himself. In fact, there's a story told about him. They say that he died when somebody, as a practical joke, gave him a glass of water. He drank it thinking it was wine, and because it was water, it poisoned him. His system couldn't handle it. All he could handle was wine. That's the way people in castles tend to spend their time. They don't eat in due season. They eat out of drunkenness, not out of self-control. And that wasn't just happening in Heidelberg 500 years ago. That was happening throughout the ancient Near East 3,000 years ago. Solomon knew about it. And so he wrote about it here. Woe to thee, O land, when thy king is a child and thy princes eat in the morning and are drunk all day long. Blessed art thou, O land, when thy king is the son of nobles and thy princes eat in due season for strength and not for drunkenness. What happens when you're lazy? Well, consider verse 18. By much slothfulness the building decayeth, and through idleness of thy hands the house droppeth through. You know, our old Volvo, every time we turned around it needed a new muffler or a new transmission. The Nelsons just had to replace the floor in their garage. We had to change our roof some time ago. The Flemings had a sump pump that went bad. I have a neighbor who tells me that whenever you buy a house, every room has a hole in the corner where you just stuff money. You always have to be fixing the thing up. Now, if you have an apartment, you don't have to worry about that. When something breaks, you tell the management, and they fix it. Maybe. Things are always breaking down. And if you're slothful, if it's your house, if you're slothful, or if it's an apartment and the management is slothful, ultimately the building decays. By much slothfulness, the building decays. Through idleness of the hands, the house droppeth through. That is a fancy way of saying the roof leaks. Drip, 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 drip. It takes work to keep things repaired. Now, he's talking about houses here, but remember the context. We're talking about the leaders of a nation. When a country's leadership is slothful, the whole country, the house of state, falls apart. It decays.
Let me ask a question there.
Sure, John.
A lot of us have meditated on why the British Empire, you know, had such power, those little islands. I believe, don't you, that part of the answer must be that their princes and their rulers were trained in diligence and discipline.
That's a good point, John.
It was largely true through the 1700s and 1800s, particularly.
They were trained, they were the sons of nobles in the sense that they were prepared for the work that they had to do. That's right, in the British Empire. And conversely, when an empire does become strong and powerful, and its princes can afford to be lazy, then it falls apart. Then it falls apart. You can trace that over and over in the history of the world.
But I've often asked myself, how could those islands, you know, with none of the advantages of the continent, dominate so much territory over the whole world? It must be because of diligence and the principles of the Bible.
I think so. The scriptures were known in England, weren't they? They were roundly preached and people followed them for a long period of time. Verse 19 shows us the attitude that the fool has, these foolish leaders. Life becomes focused on trivial things. Now, in your version, verse 19 is in the passive voice, a feast is made for laughter. But the Hebrew actually says, they make feasts for laughter. It's still talking about the foolish princes. They make feasts for laughter. Wine maketh merry, and money is the answer to everything. Now, this statement is not a statement of truth. This is a statement of how these people function in their laziness. Gluttony, drunkenness, and an attitude of solving problems by throwing money at them. Money is the answer for everything. Got a problem? Here, have a bunch of money. That'll fix it. That won't fix it. Fixing problems requires understanding the problem and getting in there and working, thinking, exerting yourself. Now, we need to remember, of course, that Kohelet recognizes the value of food and drink when we see them as a gift from God. But here we're dealing with princes who see these things as an end in themselves, and this way is folly. With verses 16 through 19 at your fingertips, you're all set to critique government. You can look and you can see folly and laziness and you can say, boy, this is terrible. People aren't doing their job. The world is falling apart. Verse 20 has a warning for you. Curse not the king. No, not in thy thought. Not even in your silent, secret thoughts. And curse not the rich in thy bedchamber. For a bird of the air shall carry the voice and that which hath wings shall tell the matter. You'll see these things in the world around you. Be very careful you don't rail against leadership and people who are in positions of power, because they'll find out about it somehow or other, and they'll come and take it out of your hide. Now, this is a very pragmatic piece of advice. It seems a little bit contrary to the ideals that we're accustomed to here in the United States, because we're used to a democratic country where the people have a voice in the government, and where if we see something wrong in government, there's a big emphasis on correcting it and making it right. But remember these things. First of all, remember that this passage is written in a day and age when rulers were totalitarian. There was no democracy. The king was the king. Rich people were in control. And if you weren't one of them, to speak against them was treason. That wasn't provided for by the government. It was a foolish thing to do, because you can get yourself in a lot of trouble. Even today, if you see yourself as set as having the responsibility of reform, be prepared to pay the cost. What this verse tells you is still true. Even in democratic society, if you set yourself against the authorities and against those with power, be prepared to pay the price. Maybe God's called you to that kind of a reforming work. But the truth stated here still holds true. You'll find yourself hurting for it. They'll find out about your discontent, and you may be called upon to pay for it. One thing more to consider, too, and that is that as Christians, our priorities in this world are not political. Our priorities are spiritual. Our citizenship is in heaven. It's not here on earth. Now, Paul says if you may be made free, use it rather. We can enjoy and we should take advantage of the freedoms that we have as Christians. But let's be very careful that we don't alienate people by taking political positions. My first responsibility toward another person is not to persuade him to vote for George Bush or Michael Dukakis. My first responsibility toward the people that I meet each day is to lead them to Jesus Christ. And it's sinful when Christians get the politics on top of the spiritual and give all their attention to reforming the government while people go to hell. So I think all in all, Kohelet's advice is very good advice. Unless the government is doing something that is directly contrary to the Word of God, we ought not to be making a lot of noise about it. Otherwise, we're going to be seen as political figures rather than as spiritual figures. And even if it is working contrary to the Word of God, when you do stand up against it, as Daniel and his friends did, you've got to be prepared to pay the price, as they did. Daniel thought he was praying privately in his room, but a little bird found out about it and told the king. And Daniel had to answer by putting his life on the line. Now, God delivered him. God may deliver us. But Kohelet's warning is still valid. Don't count on being able to criticize the government and remain anonymous. It will be found out, and you'll have to answer for it. Now, all this is by way of saying what the consequences of sloth are in the domain of rule. That is, in the domain of government. We're not going to go into the second half of this. We will, Lord willing, next week, when we'll look at the question more positively. Remember, work cannot guarantee happiness, but you still must work. These are the consequences of being slothful: decay and dissolution. Next week we'll consider an exhortation as to why and how we should go about our work, the daily responsibilities that the Lord has given to us.